Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Tanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding the Role of Personalized Medicine. And this is an important topic and one that we don't cover as often as we would like to, so this is a very important area, and it's a new area in medicine, so I think you're going to be very interested in this. Now, this is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in this novel topic that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 411 participants, and you come from all of the United States, from all different regions, and we also have international participants from Canada, Jordan, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call from all over the world. Now, today's program is made possible by Friends of Cancer Care. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speaker is going to cover. There also is information about all the collaborating organizations as resources, and there is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. Indeed, this is a new year, 2012, and we are planning many programs during this year, and we welcome your suggested topics because we are in the midst of a planning cycle of programs, and indeed, today's program is a topic that many of you have asked us to offer, so here it is, and we try very hard to implement the programs that you ask us to do. So it's very important that you tell us what you want us to do and that we will then go ahead and be sure and offer you what you're requesting. That's very important. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Stephen Grunberg. Dr. Grunberg is professor of medicine and pharmacology at the University of Vermont. And Dr. Grunberg is going to address what is personalized medicine, the benefits of personalized medicine, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grunberg.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to be speaking with all of you. Personalized medicine, it's a wonderful sounding term. Targeted therapy is another term that you're going to hear in the same sentence. The idea is that somehow we can make our treatments just totally individual to you, avoiding side effects and getting better and better and better responses. In a sense, this is true, but we have to know both the benefits and the limitations of this sort of work. In reality, we have always done personalized medicine. You can't give the same sort of treatment to everybody, and you can't treat everybody for the same thing. If you have a heart attack, I want to treat you for a heart attack. I'm not going to treat you for constipation. Even in that sense, that's personalized medicine. If you have a type of tumor that's sensitive to hormone therapy, I want to treat you with hormone therapy rather than chemotherapy. And if you have a type of tumor that's sensitive to chemotherapy and not hormone therapy, I want to give you the right treatment. I want to give you the right doses of the right treatment so that will have the best beneficial effects and have the least side effects. And I have to use all my experience to try to figure out how to do that. We use experimental work that's been done in the past, clinical trials. We use laboratory observations. We use epidemiologic observations. We've known, for example, in breast cancer for many, many years, for decades, we knew that older women tended to have a better response to hormonal therapy than younger women with breast cancer, and we personalized the care in that way. So what's new now? What's new now is that we're taking this from the epidemiologic level, from looking at different general trends, down to the genetic level. We're beginning to understand that we can actually find the genes that cause a lot of these differences in people, genes that cause certain diseases, genes that cause people to handle different drugs in different ways, to have a better effect or a worse effect from a different drug. And by taking this into consideration, we can design a treatment that's better for that individual. The benefits of personalized medicine, we would try to find the treatment that's most likely to work for you. This doesn't mean we're going to be perfect about it. It doesn't mean that we're going to know everything about you such that we can find exactly the right treatment. We still don't know that much about the genetics of the human being. We're learning all the time. We're at an intermediate point right now. You might say we used to use sort of a shotgun approach to treating these tumors, and we're trying to make it more of a sniper rifle, something that's more exact to your tumor. In the meantime, in between, what we're trying to do is improve the odds. If we knew that we had a 40% chance that a certain treatment might help you, but we know that your disease tends to be connected to a certain gene that we can target and can increase your chance of a good response from 40% to 50% or 60%, that's personalized medicine. That's targeting our therapies. And that's where we are right now. In some places, we're further ahead than others, and some we know more than others. On the one hand, we're learning more about specific diseases so that we can personalize your therapy, you might say, by getting a more personal view of your cancer. This has been particularly interesting in lung cancer. We always knew that most lung cancers were caused by smoking, but about 20% of lung cancers appear in people who hardly smoke at all. And considering how common lung cancer is, 20% of the lung cancers in the United States is about 35,000 cases a year. We now know that there are several very specific things that can go wrong with a cell that can lead to lung cancer. A gene called the epidermal growth factor receptor gene can get turned on when it shouldn't be turned on and make the lung cells grow and become cancerous. And we now can detect whether that's the case, whether that particular gene, whether that particular receptor is abnormal. If it is, we now have new drugs that specifically target that abnormal receptor. If you happen to have that kind of cancer, we can give you a drug that attacks that kind of cancer. Now, I will tell you, that particular, if you happen to have a smoking-related cancer and we give you the drug for the genetically caused cancer, it's not going to work. That would be reverse targeting. We don't want to do that. But if you happen to have the right type, and that's about 10% of lung cancers, we can give you a drug that's more likely to help you. There's another gene called EML4ALK, which also causes lung cells to become cancerous. Well, we know how to detect whether that gene is abnormal, and we now also have a drug that particularly targets that gene. This drug would not work as well in a regular smoking-related cancer, and it won't even work that well in a cancer that comes from abnormalities of the other gene I just mentioned. But if you happen to have a cancer that comes from that gene, we can give you a medication that's more likely to help in your case. Not 100% likely, but more likely than it would be in other cases, and perhaps more likely than our traditional standard treatments would be. People also think that targeted therapy, that personalized medicine, might mean no side effects, and that's not the case. It may just mean different side effects or lesser side effects. We're not quite that good yet. But as we learn more about these genetic factors, we're also learning that there are factors that can help us to predict whether our supportive care drugs, whether our medications, and whether our interventions to avoid side effects of treatment will work better or worse for different people, and we can adjust our treatments accordingly. When we're looking at, we now know of a number of genes that control whether a certain medication is metabolized through the body faster or slower, and that may affect whether the drug works better or worse, or even what the different side effects are. There's a gene called DPD that has to do with the metabolism of 5-4 urso. If you can't metabolize this drug well, you get many more side effects. And if we know that you're a person who's going to be very sensitive to the side effects of that particular chemotherapy because you have that gene, we can personalize your therapy by reducing the dose or by avoiding that drug altogether. We also know that certain types of anti-nausea drugs, for example, are metabolized by certain pathways within the body. If we know that you're a fast metabolizer, that your body's going to get rid of anti-nausea drugs faster than somebody else's, we can give you a higher dose to get around that so that they'll work better. Another form of personalized medicine. Now, we're talking about individual genes here, but when you take individual genes and put them all together, you end up with people. And we know that your genes are probably going to be, let's say, more like somebody else in your family than by somebody in another family, or somebody in your community, people who are all related or come from the same ethnic group, might actually have more genetic similarities than people from different ethnic groups. And we can start using this kind of information not only to guide therapy, but to give us hints of what genes we should be looking at. We know, for example, that African American men are more likely to get prostate cancer. Well, we also know that their bodies metabolize and handle testosterone differently. And by looking at the genes that have that effect, we know what we need to block to treat their tumors. One interesting study in the area of anti-nausea care was done actually in the Far East, in Malaysia, where they have fairly large populations of different ethnic groups. And what they did was to give people with cancer, the same types of cancer, the same chemotherapies, the same anti-nausea drugs, but then observe how they did. They looked at patients of Indian background, of Malaysian background, of Chinese background. And I will tell you that this study done in Malaysia has actually been confirmed with a study done in California, where both groups noticed that given the same amount of anti-nausea drugs, the Chinese patients tended to have more vomiting than the patients of the other ethnic groups, which says that either their bodies, that there's something about their genetic makeup that is not quite as sensitive to a standard amount of anti-nausea drug. Well, knowing that, we can begin at this point by saying, well, if I have a Chinese patient, I should start by giving a higher dose of the anti-nausea drug to get a better effect. And we can know this even in advance of treating you. As we learn more about the genetic makeup of different people, we can also go back and say, if these genes are found in this population, maybe those are the important genes for this treatment, for this tumor, and take that as a starting point for further research. What it comes down to, as you talk with your doctors, that the more your doctor knows about you, the more they're going to be able to take these things into consideration. What is your ethnic background? What are your sensitivities? Do you have any particular allergies? Sometimes something as simple as, do artificial sweeteners taste sweet to you, or do you always find them bitter? Will tell us something about your genetic makeup. It might seem to have nothing to do with the treatment, but as we learn how all of these genes and pathways are better connected, we can use this information to personalize your therapy and to improve your odds of having a better response to treatment, of having lesser side effects, and of getting through this whole process more successfully and easier. So that's what personalized medicine is, and now we're going to hear more about what we can do about it.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grunberg, for a very informative presentation. Very helpful. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Pins. Dr. Pins is clinical professor of pathology, University of Illinois at Chicago College of Medicine, Advocate Lutheran General Hospital. And Dr. Pins is going to address the role of the pathologist. He's also going to talk about the role of diagnostic technologies in understanding cancer, and how these technologies contribute to treatment decisions and choices. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Pins.
Well, thank you, Dr. Messner. Let me start off by just defining what it is that a pathologist does. Historically, the pathologist was the person that provided the diagnosis, the subtype of cancer. We also historically provided prognostic information, that is information that impacts upon how any given tumor may progress, its stage, its grade, some basic characteristics of that tumor. That's the historical role, and that's still today a very important role of the pathologist. But the role of the pathologist is very different today, and in large part because of this concept of personalized medicine, this concept of targeted therapies. When I started my residency in Boston back in 1986, many of my colleagues talked about the specialty area of molecular pathology and how it was the future. And I'll be honest with you, there was a very slow progression. Dr. Grunberg mentioned the paradigm of targeting the estrogen receptor in breast cancer, which has been around for quite a few years. And there's been some others, including c-KIT mutations, just another gene that's mutated in a small subset of certain tumors. But really, over the years, that area of molecular pathology really didn't burgeon. And today, it's taking off by leaps and bounds. And at the end of my 10 minutes, hopefully you'll appreciate what an exciting area this is for us as a pathologist and what an exciting area this is, this whole idea of personalized medicine. There is a couple of concepts that I want to throw out there that I think are very, very important concepts that will build upon what Dr. Grunberg just talked about and what Dr. Isikoff will talk about. And the first term I want to throw out there is this concept of proteomics. The proteomics refers to looking at the patient as a whole. Very often, colleagues of mine, clinicians, lay people, will talk about targeted therapeutics and looking at specific genes that may play a role in any given lung cancer and how targeting those genes might impact upon the treatment of that tumor. But the concept of proteomics is very important because we don't just look at DNA, we don't just look at RNA, we don't just look at genes. We also look at protein expression. And in the case of estrogen receptor, it's a very good example of how historically just looking at the amount of that particular receptor on the breast cancer correlated with response to that particular targeted therapy. We were actually looking at the protein. We weren't looking at gene copy numbers or DNA or RNA. There's others, including concepts of epigenetics, cytomics, looking at cells on an individual basis, but also this concept of metabolomics, I think, is an important concept. It's part of proteomics. It's part of looking at the patient as a whole. It has very little to do with actually targeting a gene that may be relevant to any given tumor. It has to do with the patient as a whole, and Dr. Grunberg alluded to how do patients handle particularly chemotherapeutic agents? How do they metabolize those? And there's differences between individuals. So the concept of proteomics, I think, is an important concept. You know, genes are kind of sexy, and you'll hear a lot about them in the literature and such, but there's much more to personalized medicine than just looking at gene copy numbers. So that's today the role of the pathologist. It's historically diagnostic, prognostic information. We still provide that, but today we do a much better job of subclassifying, characterizing tumors, that latter aspect impacting upon decisions. What has changed? Why in 1986 were we so slow, or were we just in the infant stages of personalized medicine and molecular pathology? Well, in large part, it's because of diagnostic technologies that have evolved. When I ran my lab back in Northwestern a few years ago, I would get requests from researchers to extract one type of genetic material, RNA, from tissue that had been stored away in the cabinet, and my response was always, "Well, we can help you out a little bit, but we can't really extract large bits and pieces of RNA." And in fact, there's been a technological advance over the past few years that has allowed us to do that, and that's been a game changer. That technological advance, the ability to take that particular genetic material out of stored tissues, has allowed us to do perform assays that have clinical applicability. In other words, help us to, again, further classify any given tumor. That's just one example of a diagnostic technology that has changed. There's many others. The Human Genome Project, I think, is an excellent example of information that's been provided at the basic science level that has resulted in or has translated into the clinical practice, into the daily care of our patients. So how exactly do these technologies contribute to treatment decisions and choices? I want to emphasize the importance of clinical trials. Dr. Isikoff is going to talk about this a little bit later, and let me give you a pathologist's perspective on the importance of clinical trials. So these clinical trials, whether they're in the cooperative group setting or outside of the cooperative group setting, whatever the genesis of that clinical trial is, they're critical to us as pathologists because I'm still active in one of the cooperative group clinical trials, the Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group. There's many out there. But one of the things we've been doing for years now as part of those clinical trials is embedding what we call correlatives. So for those of you that may have enrolled on a clinical trial, you sometimes sign a form that says provide these tissues to investigators to do further studies. Well, it's that part of those clinical trials that has resulted in many of these advances that help us better define any given tumor. And that's true in colon, breast, lung, melanoma, et cetera. So those embedded correlatives in those clinical trials are very, very important. In addition, we pathologists, when we're trying to provide information that may impact upon how your oncologists treat you, we rely very heavily on what was done on those clinical trials. And let me just build a little bit upon Dr. Grunberg's comment on the lung cancer. And historically, in the basic science laboratory, we've known for years that most lung cancers were mediated by a gene, a KRAS gene that's related to smoking. But and for years, the basic scientists, the biologists, knew that a couple of other genes, including EGFR and the ML4 ALK translocation, a few others, BRAF, even HER2, which we think of as being relevant in breast cancer, has relevance in a small subset of lung cancer. Well, we as pathologists, there's a variety of ways we can look at these things. We can look at the protein expression. We can look at the gene copy number. We can look at, there's all kinds of very sophisticated ways that we can look at all of these different genes. In the case of EGFR, the gold standard as defined by what was done in the clinical trials was not to look at the amount of protein that might be on the cells. It was not even to look at messenger RNA levels. It actually is to look for evidence of the mutation. And so that's what we do as part of our clinical practice to try to determine which lung cancers are driven by that. In the case of the EML4 ELK, that other small subset, small but significant subset of lung cancers, we don't look at gene copy number. We don't look at the protein. We don't look at any of these other things that I mentioned under proteomics. What we actually look at is we look for a specific translocation by a little bit different assay. This is an assay called an in situ hybridization assay. That's the reason why we take that approach is because that's the gold standard. And so that's kind of how these technologies have, these changing technologies, the results of these clinical trials have changed, basically been game changers with regards to how we approach patients. As I mentioned, it's a very exciting time in pathology, and it's exciting for me to finally see this entity, this specialty of molecular pathology take off in this era of personalized medicine.
Thank you very much, Dr. Pin. This is really a very, very informative and very comprehensive presentation. Thank you. And I think for many people, the role of the pathologist isn't always clear, so I think you've really clarified all that for everybody, and it's very helpful. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Stephen Isikoff. Dr. Isikoff is medical oncologist, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center. He's instructor in medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Isikoff is going to address novel targeted treatments, the important role of clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Isikoff.
Thanks very much. I'd like to start and spend one moment by just describing what it is that we mean when we say novel therapies. I think traditionally when we describe chemotherapy, we've been referring to the drugs we've been using for quite some time now. And these drugs aren't necessarily specific to a specific pathway in cancer cells or even to a specific cancer, but generally work by causing cancer cells to die in the general sense. The novel targeted therapies in the broad sense refers to this newer generation of therapies that we're now using that are really designed to try and target specific pathways in cells that may be really specific to a specific cancer or even to a particular subtype of that cancer. So the traditional chemotherapies are sort of the old drugs that we all know, drugs like Taxol or platinum drugs or Adriamycin or 5-fluorouracil. And these drugs generally work by blocking cell functions like causing cell damage or damage to DNA that block cell growth. These novel targeted agents are referring to some of the newer targeted drugs that inhibit pathways like that may function as the Achilles heel for a cancer. Sometimes inhibiting a single pathway alone is enough to cause a cancer cell to die off. And sometimes we need to combine several inhibitors that target several pathways together to help kill off a cancer cell. And sometimes we need to combine a novel targeted therapy with traditional chemotherapy to make that chemotherapy work better. And so this has really been a very exciting time in cancer research, and there's literally hundreds of novel targeted drugs in development now, and several of which have already been approved. Some of these drugs are oral oral drugs, and some are intravenous. And I think the movement to oral drugs has, in many ways, been a goal to try and improve the delivery of care for many patients. I want to mention a couple of different, just very briefly, specific types of novel targeted therapies. One of the very exciting areas, as was mentioned before, is to look at individual tumors and see if there's specific changes or mutations in genes that cause cancer that give us a target to go after. Some of these have very high frequencies of mutations like KRAS in lung and colon cancer, BRAF in melanoma, PI3 kinase in breast and colon and endometrial cancers, and many others. And there's now many drugs in early and late stages of clinical trials that target some of these specific mutations. You've heard this mentioned briefly, but in lung cancer, the gene for the epidermal growth factor receptor is found to be altered in about 10% of cases. And we now have drugs like erlotinib or Tarceva, which are very active in this type of specific lung cancer, but they're relatively inactive in other types of lung cancers that don't carry that mutation. In melanoma recently, there was the approval of a drug called vemurafenib. That's a novel targeted therapy that inhibits a gene called BRAF, and it turns out a substantial portion of melanomas have a mutation in that gene, and there was a lot of promise in the clinical trials that led to that drug being approved. Many companies have genes called drugs called PI3 kinase inhibitors that inhibit a gene called PI3 kinase, either alone or in combination with other chemotherapies. And as part of the personalized medicine approach, in many cases now we're able to actually test the tumor to look for these mutations. And at our institution, for example, we standardly, in many of our cancers, are testing, looking for about 100 different mutations in about 15 different cancer-causing genes. And there are many centers around the country that are now doing this, and many commercial opportunities to do this as well. When we find a mutation in a tumor, it may sometimes affect what treatment we want to use, as I mentioned, like using erlotinib in certain types of lung cancer. Just to mention a couple more novel therapies before we move on to the next topic. In breast cancer, we've been using a drug called trastuzumab for some time now for HER2-positive breast cancer. And then there was another novel targeted therapy called lapatinib approved for advanced disease that's now in clinical trials looking at early-stage disease. And this year alone, there have been several publications of two new drugs, one called pertuzumab, which works together with the Herceptin and seems to be more active than Herceptin alone. And then a really interesting drug called trastuzumab DM1, which was sort of a first-in-class type of novel therapy where they took the old Herceptin drug, but they linked to it three small molecules of a chemotherapy. And it turns out that when you give this novel drug, the Herceptin part of the drug actually targets the chemotherapy only to the cancer cells, and it really has very little toxicity, and so that's been very exciting. And then finally, in breast cancer, we've had another drug called everolimus, which is a targeted therapy approved in kidney cancer that was shown to be even more active when combined with anti-estrogen therapy. So this has really been an extraordinarily exciting time as we think about novel targeted therapies, and there are surely going to be many more that we'll see in the very near future. I want to mention how important clinical trials is in the development of these drugs and in moving cancer care forward. You've heard a little bit about this before, but I like to explain that across all cancers, really the only way we've gained the knowledge to know how to treat a cancer is really in large part thanks to the patients, the many thousands of patients who came before and volunteered to participate. The only way we can move forward is to design the most scientifically valid and best trials and encourage our patients to be active participants and collaborators with us to move the field forward. In the United States, traditionally, adults actually have a very low percentage of participation in clinical trials, whereas in the pediatric population, somewhere over 90% of pediatric oncology patients actually enroll in trials, and in some European countries, actually, rates for adults are significantly higher. One of the challenges that clinical trials face right now is that whereas before we used to think of different cancers as single diseases, we now really recognize that a given cancer is really many different diseases, and you've heard a little bit about that in the lung cancer story, but now we're really able to subtype lung cancer into EGF receptor positive lung cancer, ALK translocation positive. And all of this subtyping is actually now driving clinical trials to look in those specific subgroups, which makes the potential patient population much smaller for each clinical trial. As we further define these subgroups, our clinical trials are really trying to understand new technologies and new treatments to look at these smaller subgroups. And so getting the numbers of patients we need to answer these questions is becoming more challenging. There's many types of clinical trials, ranging from trials that are looking at new drugs and treatments to some that are looking at new technologies, and they're really at all stages of development. There are some that are looking at first-in-human studies, and there are some on the opposite spectrum that are large studies trying to get a drug FDA approved. And then there are studies that you heard recently mentioned that are asking if blood samples or tissue samples can be looked at in the laboratory. And each of these types of trials is really critically important to helping us move cancer care forward. And I would mention that the National Institute of Health maintains a website that many patients find very useful and clinicians called clinicaltrials.gov That's a tremendous resource for finding clinical trials. There are thousands of trials listed, and you can do searches, and I would encourage you to talk to your healthcare team about whether a particular trial might be of interest to you. I'd like to close by addressing some quality of life concerns. I think as caregivers, all of us on this call and all of your caregivers would agree that it's incredibly important to strike a balance between giving the most effective therapies but also minimizing the risks and the impact on quality of life. And one of the major goals of new targeted therapies and technologies is to really shift that balance more in the favor of improving quality of life. Part of this, I hope, will be gained by defining the subgroups of cancers that you've heard talked about today, so that we can really direct the therapy that's likely to give the best benefit to the right patient and really avoid causing side effects in patients who aren't likely to benefit. I think many people are familiar with the traditional side effects of most chemotherapies, and there's a lot of work going on, as you heard, to try and predict whether someone is likely to get a toxicity from a given chemotherapy. And I would argue that that also does, as you heard, fall under the umbrella of personalized medicine. But we're also focused on the patient side of therapy in the sense that there are many studies that help us assess the risk of side effects from different drugs so we can either reduce or raise the dose depending on what's necessary. In terms of the targeted therapies, many of these drugs have different side effects than we traditionally thought of, drugs that might cause a rash or diabetes or some other problems, and I think it's important for us to recognize these quality of life issues. Some of the new drugs are in pills instead of intravenous, and for some patients that's an improvement of quality of life, but we also have to be sensitive that for some patients the intravenous form may be better if taking pills is more difficult. We also recognize that participation in a clinical trial can have an impact on quality of life in both directions. Some patients feel having more access to more caregivers and nurses and doctors and nurse practitioners and that their side effects are being watched more closely is a good thing. And on the other hand, we're cognizant that participation in a trial may require more visits to the clinic, which could have a negative impact on patients' quality of life. And so we're very careful to work with our patients in this. And finally, I just want to emphasize that in achieving quality of life goals, it's very important to communicate with your healthcare team, whether you're on a trial or on a standard therapy, because part of what we do, and really the main goal of what we do, is to try and help improve the quality of life. And the only way we can do that is if we hear from our patients what's going on. And this applies to patients with early stage disease or advanced disease or patients who are in survivorship, because our goal as oncologists is really not just to treat the cancer, but it's really to help you live better with your cancer or live better in survivorship. And I think I'll stop there.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Isikoff, for a very, again, comprehensive and excellent presentation. And I want to thank all of our speakers, and we now do have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. So I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And Trinitha will explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we'll let the questions begin. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. For those of you on the web, you may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star then one at this time.
We have a question from one of our online participants, from Sherry, living in Alaska, where it often is difficult to be involved in trials because of the distance involved and cost of travel. So the question is, do any trials pay for transportation to the center running the trial?
So this is an excellent question and one that comes up a lot. We actually have patients that come from as far away. I have a patient on trial now from Iowa, and we've had patients come from California, and I have someone now coming from Maine. And some trials, particularly some very early stage trials where it's limited in who the available patient population will be, will help cover for reasonable travel expenses. So often they'll cover, if you have to drive more than 70 miles, they'll cover ground transportation. They usually won't cover airfare. They may cover some hotel stay. They typically don't pay to participate in a clinical trial. It would be important beforehand, and many clinical research nursing staff are happy to talk on the phone about these issues before you were to make an appointment. But there are some trials that will help cover some expenses, and it's important to ask those questions of the specific trial and the specific location where you'd be going ahead of time. I would also mention that some centers often have the opportunity to have philanthropic funds available to help cover patient participation in clinical trials for transportation. So it's worthwhile, again, checking with the specific site you're interested in to see what options might be available.
The National Cancer Institute often pays for initial travel expenses for evaluation for their trials. So if this is a concern, either contacting the National Cancer Institute directly or looking at their website might be a good lead.
And you can call them at 1-800, the number 4-CANCER, or visit their website at www.cancer.gov. And that actually is in all of your materials, their information. That's an excellent point. Also, of course, many of the various cancer support groups out there offer help with these type of practical and financial needs, so that for anyone on the call who's struggling with these issues, you certainly can go ahead and call the staff at Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE. But there are many other, all the different organizations listed that we collaborate with on these programs often can offer some help or help you to figure out a solution to those issues. Excellent question. We have another question from one of our online participants from Massey. When they test a tissue for EGFR, can they test it for other mutations same time to get all the results at the same time? Dr. Pins, can you address that?
Yes, and in fact, what we've done here in just outside of Chicago, here at Lutheran General, is we actually developed an algorithm for testing for all of those genes that I mentioned that are of potential relevance. And part of the reason why we developed that algorithm is very often this testing is done off biopsy material rather than the resection material. So if you can imagine, we have just often needle cores, not a lot of tissue, and it's not unusual for we pathologists, in order to fulfill our role, our first most important role as diagnosticians, we have to do some special studies. So there often is not a lot of tumor tissue left. And so up front, we've developed an algorithm where we initially test for the EGFR on a particular subtype of lung cancer, because some subtypes, the incidence of EGF, of some of these mutations is so low it doesn't justify doing the testing. But for certain subtypes, we start off with EGFR. If it's mutated, we stop. If it's not mutated, if it's what we call wild type, we'll go ahead and do that assay that I mentioned earlier, that insight to hybridization assay, looking for the translocation. Now, today, we often stop there. We don't look at some of the other genes because at least as far as the standard of care today, the additional testing may provide some prognostic information, may help to subtype the tumor, but at least in terms of targeted therapeutics, we kind of stop at that point. So the answer to your question is yes, we can often do quite a bit of testing off limited material. There are going to be situations, and this is very important, there are going to be circumstances when your surgeon or your oncologist is going to say, you know what, the pathologist has done everything they can with the tissue that's been provided, and we're going to have to take another biopsy because we need this information. That's less of an issue in lung cancer, but it is an issue in some other cancers where we now have targeted therapeutics that have relevance. Gastric GE junction adenocarcinoma, for example, is one tumor where it's not unusual for the pathologist to say, we've done as much as we can. We've exhausted what we have. If it's relevant, a re-biopsy may be necessary.
If I can just add, Carol, from a technical standpoint, a lot of the work and expense is really the work of the pathologist up front in preparing the DNA from the tumor cell. But once the DNA is prepared, if the goal is to really look for these gene mutations, that's really not where the cost is. It's really the upfront cost. So at our institution, we actually typically do this panel that I mentioned where we're looking for 100 different mutations in these 15 different genes. It was actually more cost effective rather than to try and select out which one to do, to just run the panel, because for our robotic system, the work and the expense was really that initial preparation. And so from that preparation, we can do a tremendous amount of testing. But I also want to emphasize that it is not uncommon that we need to go back and ask for another biopsy. And these are incredibly important both for clinical trials. And more as some patients might progress on a current therapy, it's actually becoming very important to re-biopsy so we can retest the tumor to help guide therapy going forward as well.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. And our next question, Shanitha?
Thank you. Our next question is from Barbara L. Your question, please.
Yes. I have an extremely rare cancer, ascitic cell carcinoma of the parotid gland and neck lymph nodes. And I can't seem to, I was told that there was no treatment for this. Can you give me any information or thought?
Just ideas of treatments. Dr. Isikoff, would you like to address that?
Well, I probably would say in this kind of setting, it's probably best not to give specific treatment recommendations so much as to say this may be one opportunity where trying to identify a center that might see this particular rare tumor more frequently, it would certainly be worthwhile to try and get in contact with. And also, this is where the clinicaltrials.gov website can be very handy. If you type in your type of tumor, clinical trials that are specifically looking at this might show up there as well. But more and more of these rare tumors are becoming of interest for clinical research because they often, we're finding some of these rare tumors may have specific genetic alterations for which we might be able to identify targets. I think I would probably leave it at there.
I would say if you're looking for advice on treatment alternatives, you might also want to look for a center that has what's called a multidisciplinary clinic. It used to be that the surgeons would work separately from the medical oncologists, from the radiation oncologists, and now more and more centers are starting to have clinics where all the different specialties that deal with a certain tumor type actually work very closely together and often see the patient together. So, for example, in our institution, the ear, nose, and a parotid tumor, the ear, nose, and throat surgeon, the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist would all be seeing the tumor together, and you can never tell when one person may have heard something or read an article that somebody else hadn't seen. And when you put three heads together, you get a better recommendation than you would from any one, no matter how smart that individual might be.
That's an excellent recommendation. And I thought, Barbara, I think the most important thing, and I'd like to talk with you after the call, is now many of you live in different regions of the country. We often suggest, of course, I would definitely recommend that you would call the Cancer Information Service. You can visit the website of the National Cancer Institute, but sometimes people find it very helpful just to call and speak to one of their information specialists because they have access to their entire database. And so, again, that number is 1-800, the number 4-CANCER, and again, that's in your materials that you received from us. But also, I think, as all of the speakers have said, it is important to get to a center that has expertise in treating the types of cancers that you have, even without the rare form of it, just the type of cancer you have, who have expertise in that. So we'll talk afterwards. But for everybody on the call, we often recommend that sometimes people consider getting a second opinion at a comprehensive center and a National Cancer Institute designated center. And I wonder if Dr. Grunberg, if you would just comment on that, what those centers are, how they operate, just so people have an idea of what they're.
There are a number of different types of NCI designated centers, but often the requirement for these is really to show that you're trying to give the best care and also do the research. Different ones will specialize in different types of research, but it is a designation that lets you know that there's an emphasis on this kind of problem at these centers.
Now we have a question from Roberto online. Does the hospital keep biopsy material in case a more sophisticated test is developed in the future? That's for Dr. Pins.
Yes, every state is a little bit different in terms of their requirements for keeping tissue. Illinois, I believe it's 10 years. Some states actually have requirements of only a couple of years hanging on to prior biopsy material. Some of those guidelines, regulations between states may be changing a little bit. Because of this concept of personalized medicine, because of this concept of the molecular classification of tumors and how it may have import on patients even 3, 4, 5 years down the line, depending on the progression of any given tumor. So every state's a little bit different. There are guidelines. Some of them are quite brief. Some of them are a little bit longer. Some institutions have policies where they maintain blocks forever. It's just part of an institutional policy, but there are there's variation between states on the minimum duration of hanging on to those biopsy specimens.
Excellent. Now we have another question from one of our online participants. Are there other health problems or medicines that could affect my biomarker levels? Dr. Grunberg, do you want to address that?
Well, again, it depends what kind of biomarker you're talking about. Certain ones are more specific than others. So, for example, there has been a lot in the news recently about PSA as a biomarker for prostate cancer, and now as it's turning out, it might not be quite as specific as we thought it was in the past. So that's a rather wide question. I suspect that the question has to do with a particular biomarker in a particular condition, and that should be discussed with your own physician to see if there's anything about your health or otherwise that might affect some of these.
Always very important for everyone to come to their healthcare, to the oncology team, with a list of their other health problems, so that that everyone is aware of those things and to ask that question. This is a good. This is often that these programs are a good practice for people to ask a question that you might like to ask your treating healthcare team, but don't quite know how to phrase it. So here you're getting absolute permission to ask your healthcare team that question. So then there's another question. What kind of preparation should a person do before meeting with their oncologist or their team, their research coordinator, in terms of just preparing for the visit to make the most out of their discussion around personalized care and medicine? I'm going to ask everyone to kind of comment on that one. It seems like it's a question that Dr. Isikoff, do you want to start first with that?
Sure, I'll start. I guess one of my rules of thumb is I always encourage people to bring someone with you to the visit. I find that in discussions with patients, sometimes you're focused on one part of the discussion, and sometimes other things that are discussed aren't necessarily captured, and it's always good to have a second set of ears, often with a paper and pen, so you can go back to. I think the other thing is to try and understand as much beforehand about what your cancer is, and at our institution, really, as a mandate sort of for national guidelines now, we're actually trying to send out some information to patients before they come to help what we're calling them decision aids, to really sort of help with thinking about your visit before you come, give you sort of an introduction to the terms that might be used and the different concepts for your cancer, so that could make the discussion more productive. It's a good idea, I think, to come with a list of some questions. I think most oncologists who you meet with will probably discuss with you first, and hopefully in their discussion cover a lot of things on your list of questions. But I think writing out some questions in advance, so that if they're not covered during sort of the discussion with your caregivers, at least you have them written down to remember. It's always a good idea to just remind yourself of your own personal family history and remind yourself of all the medications you're taking, and bring that information with you so that your caregivers can have a complete picture of what's going on. Sometimes there are things that you forget on the spot, but if you take a moment to write those down and think about them beforehand, that helps. I think those are some of the main things that I would bring up. Maybe the other people have some other thoughts.
I would like to just reinforce the idea of writing your questions down before you come to the visit itself. When you come in, there's a lot going on. It can be a very anxious time, and you may very well, even if you thought of the questions at home, you may very well forget them in the midst of the conversation or because you were trying to take notes or remember another answer. And by having that written list of questions, you're more likely to get all the things that you want answered. I'd say also remember that you don't have to get all of your questions answered at the first visit. Know your oncologist and the nurse and the team will certainly be happy to talk with you again or to answer further questions or even to answer questions for a second time. So that don't hesitate to bring up questions at a later visit as well as the first, or even to call in with questions. know, I've sometimes had, we've had patients say, I didn't want to call in because I know you were so busy. And, well, I mean, what we're busy doing is taking calls from our patients and answering questions. That's what we need to be doing. So feel free to keep that dialogue going and don't feel the pressure to get all of your answers at once.
I can just give a pathologist perspective, I think going into these meetings, knowledge is power, and the more information that you have, I think the better. There's one important qualifier to that, and that is as these technologies that I mentioned, as they've evolved and as clinical applications have popped up, there are an awful lot of assays out there that look an awful lot of the parameters that I briefly talked about. Some of these assays are not clinically validated, and that concept of clinically validated is very, very important. So whether you're getting information from friends or online or various websites, et cetera, again, information is very, very important. Knowledge is power. But I think you have to look at some of what's out there with a critical eye. And this may be, you know, one of those things that you write down pre-visit and say, you know, I went online and there's this assay out there that says it can do X, Y, and Z. Is that really the case? And the important concept is it a clinically validated assay? Is it that gold standard assay that I alluded to earlier that's been proven to work on clinical trials? So information is very, very important, but take what you get on the web and other information between friends and family and such with a grain of salt and really look at it with a critical eye.
And that's, I know it's a very important issue in terms of what people, I know you've said this, what people see in the lay press versus what's reality. And do you want to comment a bit more about that?
Comment on what? I'm sorry. Just
by what they see in the lay press, which is seeing like just the newspapers or what people suddenly hear is happening and what actually is.
Right, right.
How they found out if that's really accurate for them.
Right. And now the older I get, the more I realize that all of life is marketing. And unfortunately, we are subjected to marketing at all different levels, and medicine is no different. And it's important for us to really think in terms of what empirical data supports any given contention. And for the most part, you know, the results of clinical trials and such that are reported in the lay press, they're pretty good, they're pretty accurate. But I think it's important to just be aware that simply because may have been published in the local paper or national paper, even an international paper, or reported on the nightly news, et cetera, second, third-hand information, that it needs to be looked at with a critical eye and make that distinction between what's empirical, what's good, solid data supporting a particular approach, and what may just be a bit of a marketing tool.
Thank you. Now, we have another question from one of our online participants, which we addressed, but I just want to, who will pay for the mutation testing? I heard they are very expensive.
This is Dr. Radcliffe. I can address this in part, and then maybe the others could add in. It depends on what the testing is. For things like BRCA testing and breast cancer, there are certain guidelines that most insurances will follow. And if you meet certain criteria where the risk of having the mutation is above a certain amount, many insurances will cover that. And if not, there's some organizations that will step in and help. In terms of the tumor testing that we talked about, depending on what the purpose of it is, at our institution, we find that insurance actually does cover this as a diagnostic test. And in many cases, I think for testing insurance, if you have insurance, we'll cover it. Anything that's being done strictly for research, really, insurance isn't obligated to pay for, and many times the research trial will pay for. But for something that you could make a reasonable argument will impact your clinical decision-making, often insurance will cover that in the same way that they'll cover estrogen receptor testing in a breast cancer specimen or similar testing in other tumors. But I don't know if Dr. Pins wants to comment from his perspective.
Yeah, I have to confess, I'm removed from the billing issues, the reimbursement issues and such, and I should add happily removed from that. But there is an issue that we pathologists are somewhat struggling with, and I want to throw this out there because it's kind of an important concept, and that is, again, we try to mirror as closely as possible the the testing, the stratification, the methods that were used on the clinical trials that showed that one therapy over another showed efficacy. Having said that, there are there's been recent developments really in the past year and a half related to both BRAF testing in melanoma as well as the EML4 ALK testing in lung cancer, where not only did the FDA approve the drug, the targeted therapy, but they also approved a companion diagnostic, that is the assay that goes along with it. And there's an awful lot of laboratories that are such as ours that have for years been doing this testing. Not in a basic science lab, but we've actually been using it in the clinical setting, particularly for BRAF, in a variety of other settings, workup of Lynch syndrome, for example, and colon cancer. And we have assays in-house that we're very, very happy with, that we think are terrific assays. Now, there are some insurance companies, and I've heard this, I haven't experienced it myself, that are saying, well, no, we're not going to reimburse you for your assay, even though your assay might actually be an even better assay, because that's not the one that is FDA approved. And so it's an issue that pathologists are struggling with a little bit. We actually have validated our assay, and we've shown that actually we've got pretty good empirical data to show that our assay is actually a little bit better than the one that's out there. So there is that reimbursement issue related to some of the molecular testing. I do know that the FDA, the Companion Diagnostics Division, they've talked about that. I've actually had the opportunity to speak to their head, and this individual understands the importance, the critical role that these laboratory-developed tests that I just described, such as ours, have played in cancer care today. And they appreciate that important role, and they appreciate the issue of FDA approved versus non-FDA approved. So it's something that we pathologists are somewhat struggling with.
That is a possible issue. We've also run that, again, on the EML4 ALK setting that you talked about. You can run into the problem where there's a test, a very good laboratory-based assay of the type you're talking about, says that the patient would be sensitive to the particular drug against that mutation, but the insurance company turns around and says, well, the FDA approval only said that we shouldn't need to pay for it if it was positive by the companion test that you talked about, and might not accept the other test. So this is really something you have to look at. It's almost on a case-by-case basis, and this is where you just have to talk to your physicians and make sure that they've gotten the appropriate pre-approvals as you move forward with treatment. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of ins and outs, not all of which are scientific.
So this is excellent, really, recommendations and advice for everybody on the call, that you really want to talk with your treating healthcare team, with your physician, around some of these questions, because they're just so important for your care. And I think what I'm hearing also said is that sometimes the healthcare team is able, because of the infrastructure, to work closely in helping in any way, if it's possible, to get the adequate coverage for what you need to have done. So, and then, of course, all of the advocacy groups, everyone wants you to get the best care possible within the constraints that exist. So that's really important. So, well, I want to thank our speakers. You've been extraordinary and really just a great, also great role models of doctor-patient communication. You've all been really terrific about just explaining things to everybody in a clear way. This is a complex topic. I want to thank all of you who've posed questions, both on the telephone and online, and I also want to thank all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour education program, and that when we plan a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. So with that in mind, I do want to remind all of you of the services that you can access from Cancer Care. Now, we have a staff of 45 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services. We're people that you can talk to. We're counselors, social workers. We actually can talk with you about some of your concerns. We offer practical and financial assistance. We also offer support groups, and for many people find support groups very helpful, and we offer them on the telephone and online, so people find that very helpful, too, because you don't have to travel to them. We have these workshops, of course, many of these, which you have information about upcoming programs. And, of course, we also have all types of materials, fact sheets, booklets, and, of course, our website. So hopefully you'll take advantage of all these services. Now, Cancer Care is but one of many cancer organizations out there that has a host of free services that you can access. And I don't, as we conclude, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I don't want you to think that you're alone in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and where all of us are simply a telephone call away, or a website away, take advantage of those services. Again, to contact Cancer Care, it's 1-800-813-HOPE. I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect, and have a wonderful day.